Post-Harlan Monologics. Number 00042. Recorded on April 26, 2023. Production location, Post. Harlan. Texas. Chapter 42.
The opinions of Maverick 88 are not necessarily the opinions of Maverick 88. Sensitive content warning. Viewer discretion is advised.
Now, buckle up. You are on the runaway train of thought. Ladies and gentlemen, without any further ado, the one, the only, Maverick 88.
Way back in 1969, Johnny Cash performed at the San Quentin prison in California, and it was recorded and it was produced as a LP, as an LP, released again in 1969. And amongst the songs that were on that LP was what some regarded as his most famous song, a song called A Boy Named Sue. A Boy Named Sue. Now see, to my taste, this is not Johnny Cash's best, right? Let me explain. This is a song written by somebody else. You know, you could say a cover in a sense. And it seems to have gotten to the point at that particular point in time that so many of the country artists that I really liked had gotten into this routine of not writing their own songs anymore, which I think is Johnny Cash at his best. His best music was the shit that he wrote himself in the 50s, early 60s. You know, wrote it himself, sang it himself, and that was his best. And then besides that, as far as covers go, his best covers was the last things he did right before he died, right? But that's a whole nother story. Like Hurt from Nine Inch Nails I brought up before, right? As far as I'm concerned, his creative career, the bookends of it was the best he did. What he did in the beginning and what he did at the end. And in the middle somewhere, there was this period where he was doing a lot of covers of a lot of songs. And this Boy Named Sue was one of them, right? And it was written by a guy named Shel Silverstein. Shell, short for Sheldon, right? The name Sheldon. Shell Silverstein, who was a prolific writer of really all kinds of stuff. Articles, books for adults, for children, comics that ended up like in Playboy magazine, and then a lot of songwriting, right? Now, I'm not a big fanboy of this guy and his life. I don't know everything about him, but I do know this. There's a lot of country music that a lot of people don't realize was spawned by this guy, right? Now, Boy Named Sue was one of those songs. Other artists, country artists, Bobby Bear, Tom Paul Glazer, these guys that I really like, they would do a bunch of songs that these guys wrote. And then shit that isn't even country, for a famous example. The fuck were they? Dr. Hook, right? They did a lot of songs that were written by this guy. And back to country, Loretta Lynn, right? Who recently passed away. Loretta Lynn, the older sister of Crystal Gayle, right? She did a bunch of Shel Silverstein songs. So there's a whole a whole chunk of popular 70s, you know, 60s and 70s country music, which I think is the sweet spot of country music, right? It's the pinnacle of it all. It doesn't exist without this guy's pen, right? Some of the great country songwriters of the time were him and Kris Kristofferson, who did a whole lot of stuff. Hell, Kris Kristofferson even covered Shel Silverstein songs. All right, so the guy was very well known in that circuit, and you know, obviously widely used. But I'll leave it at that. See, Johnny Cash didn't write this song, A Boy Named Sue. This guy did. I like Johnny Cash's, really all artists. I like them writing their own stuff and performing their own stuff. That makes it complete for me. Cover tunes, they can be done very well, but I prefer original compositions being performed by those who composed them. It's just too, it's a thing with me. So anyway, the song, right? Eventually, the backdrop is Gatlinburg, Tennessee, right? Gatlinburg, Tennessee. Gatlinburg was not very far at all from where I used to live in Tennessee, right? Smoky Mountain Town, right at the very edge of the Smokies, pretty much in it. I mean, Gatlinburg's pretty much in it. I was in the foothills. I was in one county over west, right, where I lived from Gatlinburg. Gatlinburg is a very, very popular, well-known tourist town. You know, it is the tourist destination of the Smoky Mountains. It tends to be the choice of rednecks and Europeans, you know. It is an international destination. I've seen it with my own eyes multiple times. Great place to go, but, you know, frankly, a lot of American people from the coasts, from the cities, don't really even know about it, you know. But Gatlinburg is right there, at the, you know, right in the Smoky Mountains. It is a tourist town. You could call it a tourist trap. You could piss away a lot of money there, but it's, you know, as far as they go, it's probably the best one I've ever been to, you know. To me, it's very enjoyable. It's basically a strip, you know. It's a strip up and down. The south end of it, you go up into the mountains, right? The north end of it, you go up into a couple of other tourist towns. Pigeon Forge, right? The next one north. That's where Dolly Parton comes from, and that's where her Dollywood amusement park is. Pigeon Forge. Now, Pigeon Forge is different than Gatlinburg. It's more automobile traffic, right? It's kind of like a highway going through. It's a strip, but you drive, and everything is set back on off the road. You know, you pull off, and you have parking lots. Gatlinburg, it's all foot traffic. It's more city-like. You know, all the establishments, their front doors open right to the sidewalk. So you park somewhere, and you walk around all day over there. But you go to Pigeon Forge, you take your car, your minivan with all the kids and everything, and you go from your hotel or motel to the wax museum, and then to the go-kart park, And you just, you know, get in your car every time and just go to the next parking lot down, next parking lot down. And next town up from Pigeon Forge is Sevierville, right? Sevierville, Tennessee, which is laid out the same way Pigeon Forge is. But now you're starting to, like, pull away a little bit more from the tourist stuff. Even though there is tourist stuff there, it becomes more of a local population. It's kind of mixed together in Sevierville, the way I remember it anyway. And I've been out there. It's not like I don't know. I've been out there, but things may have changed since then. I don't really know. Sevierville, you know, I just got a new knife. My mother bought me a gift. My birthday's coming up. The knife came in the other day. And just to mention it, just to say it, it's Topps Woodcraft is what it's called. Topps. Topps is a knife company out of Idaho. And all the production is done there. So this is made in Idaho. It's not a cheap knife. Not a cheap knife at all. It's a very nice gift. It's a fixed blade knife, full tang. Blade is 4.5 inches. So it's not very big. It's a small fixed blade, at least by my standards. really nice, though. Beautiful. It's designed after the old tried and true marbles woodcraft design. And the blade is actually designed in the same manner. Handle, the grips are different. I guess that's Topps' unique thing. It's got the micarta type of grips on it. Really good, though. Really good. A lot of weight down in the hand, like I like it. It's balance. I wouldn't call it just balanced, like you put the middle in the finger. It's kind of one-sided, but down in the grips. But I kind of like it like that anyway. Very nice. Why do I bring that knife up? Because it got sent out to me from Smoky Mountain Knife Works, which is in Sevierville, Tennessee, right? Smoky Mountain Knife Works. It's one of the, like, three knife distribution organizations, companies that I generally will deal with as a matter of trust, right? That's where it came from. My mother lives out there, so it just it all came from there. Everything nice and neat, and that's that, right? Smoky Mountain Knife Works. If you hear me talking about knives and you want to look at the knives I'm talking about, go to their website. It's smkw.com or something like that. You know, just type in your search criteria, your search query, Smoky Mountain Knife Works. It'll come up. Good company. Have had no problems with them at all. Anyway, the basic premise of the song Boy Named Sue, right? The basic premise is to toughen up or die. I guess that's the way I sum it up. There's really a lot to the song. It's a ballad, right? It's a ballad, and the story in the ballad goes basically like this. You had a father who had an affair with some woman. The woman got pregnant. The pregnant woman decided she was going to have the baby. The guy decided he was going to have nothing to do with it. So he did one thing before he left. And he named the boy Sue. And then he was gone. So now the boy's got to grow up. And he gets picked on. He gets bullied and all this shit. And then eventually as an adult, he runs into this father of his that he recognizes somehow, maybe from a photograph or some shit like that. I don't know. But he recognizes this guy, and he confronts him, and they get into a fight, right? The knives come out, the guns come out, and they're fighting to the fucking death. And it turns out the kid's a real scrapper. And right before he's about to kill the father convinces him to stop and hear him out. And he explains to him that he had to do that knowing that he wasn't going to be around to guide him, to instruct him, to protect him, whatever was required, dealing with all the bullying and all that. Giving him this name, Sue, he would get picked on and he would toughen up. or die. And those were the choices then, right? There was toughen up or die. Very black and white. There was no gray area there. There was no no consideration to the idea of like not toughening up and yet staying alive, right? That would be the gray area, being kind of weak, not tough, and alive, not dead. And like, that's just something I observe, you know. It's like, is there another option in there? Well, I guess there is, because we've seen it, you know. We've seen it play out in society where the children have been coddled to the point of spoiled. Not just this current generation, but the one before it too. So we're like two generations deep into this coddling theory of fucking parenthood, which I observed, you know. I observed, when was it? Early 90s. First time I really laid eyes on it. My brother and I were coaching a teenage boys baseball team, right? The 13, 14, and 15-year-olds, a couple of 16s mixed in there. It's been junior high through like junior varsity kids. And we observed through that experience the way parents had changed. They, you know, where it concerned their kids, we were being confronted almost continually for a while by parents who were telling us their kids should be playing here, they should be playing more frequently, la da da. They had all their ideas, and they were really trying to impose their will on us. And well, that couldn't be done to me because I couldn't give a fuck. I was there to coach baseball, and that was that, you know. And I come from old school and hard knocks where it came to baseball. I know a whole fuck ton of shit about baseball. I really do. All kinds of levels of it. I was the pitching coach is what I was. That was my specialty over there. But my secondary specialty was dealing with these parents because I couldn't give a fuck. You know, if they wanted to do something, if they wanted to pull politics and get me kicked out of the league, and go for it. I didn't care. I had better things to do to coach a team. I was hanging out with my brother is what I was doing. We were starting to get old and starting to go separate ways, you know. We've gone separate ways. We've come back together a couple of times in life, and that was one of them, you know, usually around sports. But we did that back then together, you know. And but that's all it was about. It's a fond memory for me, except for these fucking parents. But we were seeing they were starting to coddle and spoil children in a different way. They couldn't just like drop the kids off for practice or for a game and walk away. Or they could stay and watch the game, but they always had to say something. They always had to be commentary. I didn't remember it being so much that way when I was young playing ball. Now, there was a lot of times I had to walk to the game by myself, get a ride from somebody else. We didn't have coaches on our fucking team. We had to write our own lineups and shit. A couple years that I played. That's all Generation X stuff. It's a whole different way, you know. Good, bad, and different, I don't know. But the results are starting to play out now. We have two generations of basically spoiled brats. With exceptions, you know, exceptions. To now, like it's always been, the kids who've gone off into the army because they come from a situation that wasn't really open up to a college education, one reason or another, they end up coming out toughened up and more responsible and more accountable, right? Of course, what's going on to the fucking military now, the woke ideology and all this shit, that may not be the case. And that's probably the intent, and I'll probably get into some of this stuff. It's probably the intent of people, the powers that be, to not have the military of the United States be an outlet where young people can actually grow up to be fucking normal anymore. They're going to abnormalize even that. Which bugs me because I have two stepsons that are in the military, right? But I think they already had toughened up before this shit really started to lock in. And that happened in 2021, you know. One of them was in before that, and the other one, and that one coaches the other one through. Anyway, a little bit personal there, but I'm pretty sure these two guys will pull through without being all socially impacted by the degeneracy of these fucking sick sociopathic elites. Anyway, is there an option, you know, toughen up or die? Yeah, you can be a spoiled brat, basically. You could be coddled. You could live in a cocoon. You could be prevented from encounters with adversity, like bullying, for example. You don't toughen up, but you stay alive, you know? And now we've got what we've got. Generation, literally generation upon generation now, two generations of coddled upbringing. And that is a big part of the foundation of this fucking beta male world that we live in now. Or at least the veneer that mainstream media is putting on us that would have us believe that this is the world that we're living in. I don't believe it's the world we're living in. I believe far and away the shit that they are trying to impose upon us as being quote-unquote popular is not. But anyway, it's you plug into the fucking TV set and it's a beta world. They're making you into one. They're cutting your fucking nuts off every time you spend an hour watching television. Just more and more. They're just sucking the fucking sperm out of your testosterone. And ultimately the testosterone out of your nutsack. The beta world we live in. Shit, I mean, a boy named Sue, right? Now they're naming themselves Sue. It used to be the father would name the boy Sue to toughen him up. Now they're not tough, and they just name themselves Sue. And they don't expect no bullying or no mockery. Because why? Bullying as an institution has by and large been culturally eradicated. Now, I'm not saying bullying is a good thing, but I am saying it's a necessary thing. Because bullying is more than just the big fat kid on the block stealing your lunch money and smacking you around. Bullying happens well into your adulthood. So it's something better dealt with as a child, way young. So your lessons can be implemented as you enter into adulthood. It's coping skills. And, you know, it's a natural course of events. People are going to bully. People are going to be bullied. And I tell you what, most of us will do both. Most of us will have lessons to learn on both ends of that stick. I was bullied when I was a kid, and then I bullied other kids. And that's not abnormal. I think that's exactly how it goes. And you learn lessons from being on both sides of that. And I think it's a necessary type of evil in our humanity. We cannot be coddled. And we cannot hide from that which is prevalent, that's always going to be there. I'm a Christian, right? And in my worldview, the big problem is sin in the world. Now, I can't just like put my hands over my eyes and pretend sin isn't there, and then walk through life in that manner, with my hands over my eyes, blind, see no evil, right? But this is what we do. This is the shit we try to get away with. We try to pretend reality isn't real. So now we're like having to deal with all this nihilistic ideology that there is no absolute truth to anything, and that we could reshape our thinking and redesign society as a whole based on ultimately non-reality, our fantasies and our nightmares, whatever, as long as it isn't real, it can fly. It's a whole lot of bullshit, right? And we're living in a world of a whole lot of bullshit. The beta world, it's a lot of bullshit, you know. So now they naming themselves Sue, and it would seem as if in our society, in our culture, at least as the mainstream propagandists would have us believe, the inmates are running the asylum, right? The inmates are running the asylum now. And you got to ask yourself, how did we get to here? Is this the American dream? Now think about it. Just think about it for a second. You know, we all talk about the American dream. How you doing today? Living the dream. Then that's what it means. You're living the American dream, and the American dream, and I'm going to get into exactly what the fuck that's all about, but it's basically suburban living. It's basically creating a family and living out in the suburbs and expecting for that to be the ideal, the pseudo-utopia, where everything just seems to be great. Everything is designed for everybody's health and happiness. And yet, so many generations into suburbia, what do we have but a culture where, if it isn't so, they're trying to make it so, where the inmates are running the asylum, right? The inmates are running your asylum. From the get-go, the American dream. Well, to take it all the way back, was to come to the new world in search of opportunity. It was the immigrant's dream. But for those who are here already, whether born here, native to here, or an immigrant, you're here. Now, what is the American dream? The American dream for, say, Vito Corleone at the age of 9 years old, all alone and sickly in a room on a bed in Ellis Island, the American dream was not the tenement districts that the immigrants were relegated to, but you get what you get until you can get something else. And see, as it was at the turn of the century, the American dream was to flee those conditions. In 1965, Eric Burdon and the Animals, right, part of the British invasion of rock music, released a song called we got to get out of this place. Which, of course, for you Fear fans out there, the punk rock band, Lee Ving and Fear, my favorite punk rock, they redid that song in what I regard as a sarcastic manner, but that's a whole different story. Eric Burdon and the Animals, We Got to Get Out of This Place, 1965. Here's your opening volley of lyrics. First verse, in this dirty old part of the city, where the sun refused to shine, people tell me there ain't no use in trying. And there's additional verses that leads to chorus. The chorus is, we got to get out of this place if it's the last thing we ever do. We got to get out of this place. Girl, there's a better life for me and you. Now, we're talking about the American dream, and this is British music, but the sentiment is the same. The American dream is to flee the intolerable conditions of urban living in search of something happier and healthier. Now, historically speaking, going back to, say, Vito Corleone, the turn of the century era and early 1900s, to be an immigrant and to live in a tenement district of a city, as Little Italy was at the time, right? In Manhattan. Aspirations of leaving there were only aspirations because there was really nowhere else to go. There was a time in this country where you had only urban living and only rural living, and there was no in between. There was no gray area. And the rural living back then was not quite the way it is today. With technology and the amenities. No, when you were a rural person 100 years ago or more, you lived off of your land. And that was basically the end of it. You may have had your surplus that you would cart, and I use that word, cart, quote-unquote cart, your goods into market to sell. But outside of that, you're pretty much on your own. In fact, I was talking with my mother-in-law the other day, who's an old-timer, late 70s, pushing 80, and she grew up in a rural manner. Back in the day, not 100 years ago, obviously, but here in Texas, 60, 70, 80 years ago, things were quite different than they are now, and a lot closer to the way they were 100 years ago. And she described to me a way of living that required no purchase. Think about it. Like, you didn't need money. She told me the only things that they bought was flour, sugar, and coffee. They bought nothing else. They made their own clothes. They grew their own food. And that's how they lived. Now, not everybody rural in the 40s and 50s in Texas lived to that extreme, right? That homesteading quality of life. You know, that's like a pioneer lifestyle, basically. You know, there was other people who had means, and, you know, there was tractors and shit back then, and there was reasons to go into town, have things repaired, you know, buy parts and shit like that. But, you know, before you had motorized vehicles, and this is the point I'm getting to, you couldn't have a Suburbia. You just couldn't do it, because the work was always going to be in a city area, or perhaps a factory town, which is really just a small city with an economy based on the factory. You could not commute. You could not decide, well, I'm going to live in the country and commute to the city, because you'd have to do it by fucking horseback, and you might have to row a boat over the river. That kind of stuff, right? That's how it was back then. And the point I'm getting to is suburbia really wasn't possible until the inception of the automobile. Now, the automobile became, you know, a road traveler. It was also, you had motorized, mechanized tractors that changed rural living and really connected it to town life, created more need. Both the automation of vehicles was an entirely brand new industry that created factories, and factory towns sprung up as a result of them. It was a sensational invention that lent to the possibility of a lifestyle in this country that would be very unique to the United States, which is suburbia, suburban living. That is an American thing. And it was only made possible by, well, not only just the automobile, but also highways, roadways. Once upon a time, there weren't much more than a path or a dirt lane to get to anywhere, you know? So you needed highways, a highway system. And you see that every time, you know, like living here in post-Arlen, Texas, right? And the DFD portion of DFW portion of post-Arlen, Texas. You could pretty much sit like on a rooftop and just watch the urban sprawl. You could see it fucking growing to the east and to the north. You see it, watch it happen as it happens on a daily basis. But for it to go any further out, the infrastructure as it is has to be reconstructed. Roadways that lead out into the country that are one way out and one way in, a two-lane road, need to be widened to four lanes or more to accommodate the population growth that's about to happen out that way. Right? Infrastructure upgrades. So even to begin a suburbia, you had to start with the construction of new infrastructure that would accommodate the automobile, because the automobile was the only vehicular means by which people could actually live outside of the city and yet commute to their jobs and get there on time, you know, without it being like a fucking 4-6 hour ordeal on horseback. Or, like I said, rowing your boat across the fucking river. You know what I mean? But here, this is the whole thing. Suburbia could not happen until we had the automobile and the highways that accommodated the automobile. And as a lifestyle, suburbanites depend on the automobile. All right? You could live in a city and never have a need to drive. Buses, subways, and walking proximity to most of anything that you would ever need. That's a lot of the upside of the city, right? In the suburbs, it ain't like that. You don't have commerce in your subdevelopments. When you need to get a pack of cigarettes, you got to go, right? This is a story I tell about friends of mine, right? Well, I lived in Bridgewater Township in New Jersey. I lived in the smaller village section of it called Martinsville. But I had friends that lived in Bridgewater proper, not in any village. And it was all suburban, right? And if you lived out in the middle of suburbia, if we're hanging out, smoking pot, drinking beers, playing music, doing what we do, like in the middle of the summer, out of school, and fuck, I don't have any cigarettes left. You got one I could bum? Well, I only got two left. I guess we got to go to the store, right? Well, now you got a 5-mile walk to get to the store. And that's kind of what it's a little bit like living in the suburbs, especially if you're a kid, right? You don't have immediate proximity to everything. You have to get into a car and drive. So there's a dependency, right? Suburban living requires the automobile. There's a synchronous relationship, or actually a symbiotic relationship between suburbia and the automobile. They need each other. They require each other. But without going too far down that particular roadway, like I said, now the American dream is the idea of getting out of that city life. It's your aspiration into something greater than what you were born into in the neighborhood. And what you seem to be trapped with. Especially 100 years ago. There was no alternative for you if you wanted to leave. You had to stay. The only thing you could really do is go to another city. But you're still in a fucking city. The lifestyle is the same. Right? If you were well-to-do, if you managed to inherit money or something like that, perhaps you could go out and buy land and homestead it. Have a go at it. That's pretty much what it takes. It's a hard life, but a rewarding life. But again, out there in rural America, you sacrifice a lot of conveniences and amenities. It's not so bad now as it was back then, but still, you think about it. You think about being my age, right? And my condition. Mid-50s, I've already had a heart attack in my life. If I decide, so you would think, on that basic trajectory right there, that there's going to be another heart attack in the future. Now, if I'm living like 30 miles outside of the city limits or more, and I decide that I'm going to be out, I don't know, fucking tilling the fields, right? And I clutch my chest and drop to my knees and fall over with a fucking heart attack, what are the odds of me getting hospitalization that I need in time before I die, right? This is some of the amenities that we sacrifice. So it's pretty much a requirement that when you're living out that way, you take care of yourself internally and medically. You got to learn how to do all this kind of shit. It's a DIY situation, and it's really I love my time out in the country, and I want to go back. But understand, you know, that's part of the trade-off between urban living and rural living. And now we've got this in between. Now we can leave the city, leave the apartments, leave the projects, right? And what do? We go out, we strive out. Like you leave Manhattan, you go out to Jersey, right? You get over the river, you go to the Jersey side. And what do? You get a house with a yard, the white picket fence, right? Because that's the proverbial white picket fence. That white picket fence has become the actual symbol, right? The old-timey symbol of suburbia. That's the way it was once upon a time. You put the white picket fence up. Why? That contained your little animal, your little terrier, or your little schnauzer, your little poodle, right? Some kind of small dog that's not going to be able to jump up 3 or 4 foot, right? And so you have that little 3 or 4 foot white picket fence that wrapped around your front yard, and so did your neighbor, and so did your neighbor's neighbor, and the mailman walks up and down the road, and everybody waves to each other, and, you know, that was the American dream. And in the first wave of it, that was more or less the way it was. You can go back into really probably the heyday of this nation, right? Probably the most glorious time. Not for every single person that lived in it, okay? Just as a whole in general, I think the nation peaked out as a nation right up to the point of the assassination of John F. Kennedy. You may have heard me speak of these things before. 1963 or so, that's about where we peaked culturally as America as a whole. Now, from that point in time, most everything has degenerated, but there has been positives, right? Civil rights advancements on the cultural level is progress for sure, right? And then technological advancements, again, progress for sure. We still manage to do some good things, but, and I'll probably get into a little of this as we go, generation by generation, we are degenerating. It's really a peculiar dynamic, but that's humanity for you, right? You got one foot in the good and one foot in the evil, right? The Garden of Eden, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, that duality persists in us as individuals and amongst us culturally, right? But anyway, that's getting a little side from the point. Talking about the white picket fence. The white picket fence is the symbol of the American dream, which is escaping the city out into suburbia, right? Now here in Texas now, we don't really do the white picket fence thing. We do the privacy fence thing, which is a picket fence, but it's generally not white. It may be. It's your choice. But it surrounds your yard, especially your backyard, not so much the front yard, right? Typically, you have an open front yard and a fenced-in backyard where the white picket fence ideal and imagery, it comes from a front yard application, okay? suburbia has kind of evolved in its own way over the years. And I'll get into a little bit of the back history of that probably as we go here, time permitting. But the white picket fence in the beginning was the way suburbia was done and remains to be the symbol. Most people don't have a white picket fence in their yard, but a lot of people make that reference when they're talking about living the dream, living the American dream, aspirations for marriage and children and family life. The old white picket fence, you know, the house with the white picket fence. In fact, the white picket, I'm actually in the process of building a white picket fence in our front yard now, right? In our little slash of somewhere between urban and suburban life. We live in that little fucking gray area between Urbania, the city, and the gray area of suburbia, right? There's like the suburbia is the gray area between urban and rural life, but then there's a little gray area between suburbia and urban life. That is to say, I live in a city, but it's very suburb like. But I think in my definition of city living, whereas you have either little to no front yard, and then you have walking proximity to commerce in general, right? That kind of sets you apart as urban living. Whereas in suburbia, you don't have walking proximity. You may have little to no front yard, but you'll probably have some front yard. You know, it wouldn't be little to no. You will have some front yard. It'll be little. It'll almost definitely be little. Some may be larger than others, but you'll have something. But you will not have walking proximity to amenities, to commerce. You have to get in that fucking car and go, right? So my neighborhood actually qualifies as a city in that regard. And I do live in a city, and the downtown area of the city is actually walking distance. At the end of my block, there's a factory. And across the street from that, there's a mechanic. And next to the mechanic is a bodega, a convenience store. And next to that is a barber. And up the road from that, there's a gas station. And there's a fast food place. There's a Baptist church. There's a fucking oil change mechanic on the corner. And then you go down the other way, the other end of my neighborhood. You get downtown. Before you even get downtown, there's an actual community college right there. All walking distance. All this is walking distance. The train station. You can go to the train station on foot and be in Dallas in like 10, 15 minutes, not even. Downtown, right? On a train. And another gas station. And then like just the entire downtown area. Banks and churches and restaurants and theaters and parks and all that shit right there, right? It's all walking distance, and my neighborhood's butt up to that. It's the first rung of outskirts to the actual city, the downtown area, but it's not exactly suburbs because the proximity is still walking distance, right? So I am not exactly suburbia. That's the point I'm trying to make. But nonetheless, I'm putting up a white picket fence right now. I'm a little bit more than halfway done with it. I started it over the weekend. I ran out of time and materials on day one. And I'm waiting for this weekend to roll around to continue with it and hopefully wrap it up. But my white picket fence is not a functional white picket fence, right? It's not made to contain an animal. It's not made to keep the neighborhood kids off my damn lawn. Get the hell off my lawn! Right? Oh, that was a big deal when I was a little guy, right, where I lived. My neighborhood was similar, right, to what I'm living in now. Almost the same damn thing, just like a New Jersey version of what I got here in Texas now, right? And this is before I was out in the suburbs, or I still lived in the city, in these city neighborhoods. Very similar to like what you would see if you're watching All in the Family, right? The sitcom with Archie Bunker as they're rolling the opening credits and they're panning down the street house to house. It's a very similar circumstance to that neighborhood in Astoria, Queens, as it was, right? Queens, New York, for the TV show. As a kid in New Jersey on the other side of the river, right? A similar type of neighborhood. We had a mix of people, right? You had young families and you had old timers and something in between. And, you had World War II vets. Shit, you had World War I vets back then, right? Like my neighbor across the street. This is what I'm talking about, right? We had this old couple across the street that were in their 70s, maybe 80s, but they're definitely in their 70s. And do the math. If they're 70 in 1972... Well, they're damn near World War I era people, right? Roaring 20s, technically, you know, in that case. But anyway, that's irrelevant. They were old people, and they had their little tiny patch of front lawn, right? These were these neighborhoods, just like the ones I live in now. City neighborhoods, but with a little tiny patch of front lawn. And I mean a little tiny patch, like, from your fucking door to the sidewalk might be maybe 8 feet. I don't think ours was. I think ours was more like 6, right? I mean, there was like no lawn up there. But we did have a hedgerow that was kind of, say, maybe, let's just say 8 foot, right? That's your fucking lawn. That's your front lawn in a city neighborhood that has lawns, 7 or 8 foot. And these guys, this is what we did. And I'm thinking about doing it just for laughs, because I know we got some old timers in the neighborhood still. You know, my in-laws, for example. If I do this, they'll know, they'll recognize this shit. They'll laugh, right? Because this is the way things were done back in the 70s. You throw down lawn seed, right? And then you got to tack up stakes around the corners of your front yard. And then you tie string to the stakes on top. And then you hang keep off the grass signs, right? When I was a little kid, they were everywhere. And I was a little kid, so I was like the neighborhood menace. I come walking down the street, and I'm exactly what this old-timer who's got his grass seed down and his signs up and a lawn staked out. I'm the guy that he's just waiting for. I'm the reason he had to stake up them fucking those signs, right? And I'm thinking about like replanting, not just resodding. I'm probably going to end up just getting some squares of St. Augustine. I talk about the grass and shit on previous episodes, but I'll probably just end up getting some squares of that, plotting them down strategically and letting them just naturally run out and grow together and just fuck it. Fuck this year, it's going to be a shit lawn. Next year, it'll all come together, right? Or ripping it all up and throwing down seed, old school style. I could do that with Bermuda grass or certain ryegrass and even fescue, which is common to New Jersey, right, where I grew up. They have a lot of it out in Georgia when I lived out there. There are other options, and I've considered that. I'm still considering that, but those are all seeding types of lawns. And if I do that, then I'm going to have to get the fuck off my lawn signs right all over. I don't know. I think that's funny as shit. That's so old school. And it's the kind of crap that all of us old Generation Xers and beyond probably have forgotten about until I just reminded all y'all right now. I bet you anything, right? But so the white picket fence. It's not going to contain anything. It's not going to retain anything. It is strictly decorative, right? Strictly decorative. All it is an indication. It's a little accoutrement, a suggestion, if you will, about something suburban, something idyllic, something American dream, right? That's all. But it's going to be cool. It's going to be cool. And even halfway done, it's already made an impact on that yard. Now, it's not white yet. It's still raw wood and everything like that. But I got a landscaping project going, and a pretty significant statement within the artistry that I am presenting to my neighbors will be just this little hint of a white picket fence, right? One little section of the yard. But it's, it's strictly decorative, and it's even somewhat sarcastic because my neighborhood is by no means anybody's vision of an American dream. I live in a bad neighborhood, right? It's a shitty, rundown, old neighborhood that really needs to be leveled and redeveloped. So there's a little bit of sarcasm in my artistic landscaping statement. But what a pain in the ass, though. I mean, I'm building, right? I didn't just say I'm putting up a fence. I'm building a fucking fence. And the reason why is I started shopping it out. And it's not the first time. I'm an old dude, and I've had yards and things like that. You could just buy like sections of little, what they call garden fences, and stick them up, right? You can literally just hold it up, kind of level it out, and tack it down with a hammer, right? And then get another section, put it up against the side of it, and do the same thing. And just bada bing, bada boom, for like $30 or so, depending on how many sections of it you need, you got yourself a little white picket fence. Maybe take you an hour of labor. Maybe not. And so I was thinking in terms of that when I was plotting out this vision of a front yard that I have. And I get online and just start shopping around, right? I go to the box stores like Tractor Supply and Home Depot and Lowe's, the common shit for this kind of stuff. And I'm looking for garden fences and any kind of like small picket fence, whatever they may be calling them, because you know how we invent words and redefine old stuff all the fucking time, right? I'm finding the garden fence, and I'm seeing two, maybe three basic problems with what I'm faced with here. Problem number one, they mostly made out of plastic. I'm not looking for fucking plastic, okay? I'm not going to be that sarcastic about it, right? But not all of them. Some of them are still wooden, right? That's not much of a problem. But problem number two, getting the exact kind of sizing and styling that I want. A lot of garden fences, for example, they'll be like, if you can imagine, 1.5, maybe 1 inch, 1.5 inch slats, right? All right, that's the up and down part, the vertical running portion of your picket fence, the actual picket, right? They will have maybe like 1 to 1.5 inch wide pickets, and they'll be separated by like 5 inches or 6 inches. So they're just stupid little things, right? To me, I look at that, like a 4 foot section of that, that's like a fucking $2 or $3 item. Very common. And all that does is maybe keep your schnauzer from jumping over, you know, because you get the little pointed fucking stakes every so often they can catch their ribs on. Or it's just a decorative thing to literally just put around your little garden, you know. Maybe keep a bunny rabbit out. I doubt it. I don't think so. I think they'd get in there for food, but they're too short and the pickets are too spread apart too much. Then they got other ones that are still too short, but taller than that. I mean, when I say too short, these things are only like 8 inches. I'm looking for 24, right? I was actually looking originally for 20, and then I upped it to 24 at the last minute for good reason, and it worked out well. And but the largest, the closest I was coming to size in that was, well, there might be one or two odd things that were like 18. And then it just would jump from 18 to like 36. And there was like no in between. And all right, that sucks. And then the styles, even if I went for something, all right, well, I'm looking for 20, but there's an 18. That's kind of close. I think I could just settle for that. And then the styles are kind of weird. They don't really go with what I have in mind. I'm not looking for anything fancy at all. This is going to be a straight-up picket fence, you know. So no arcs, no bows, nothing weird. So I was kind of shit out of luck. And then on top of it, the real serious problem of it is all, like I described this little section of short and unwanted, undesirable, stylistically unsuitable, ordinary fucking garden fence that I would assume to be like $2-3 a 4 foot length. No, they're kind of more like $30, you know, just for that shit. And then for something that's actually more realistic, maybe that 18 inch one that's made out of plastic and it's not exactly the shape or design I want, but it might do the job. For a 4 foot section, they want $75 fucking dollars, right? $75. And of course, I need 24 foot section in total, right? That's how much fencing I'm putting up here for this little project. So you're talking 75 times six. You're into hundreds of dollars for just a decorative accoutrement. Fuck that, right? So I go back to my old Generation X do-it-yourself DIY ways, and I decide I'm going to have to build my own fence. And all said and done, and not counting man hours and labor or anything, just the product itself, I'm gonna get out of it for under $150. And that includes the paint and everything, the screws, you know. I get to do the work. But you know what? The work is actually satisfying. It really is. It's satisfaction. And it's like double satisfying because I know, like, when I pull up at night and I see just what I've done so far, just what I see so far, I've already got that sense of accomplishment, right? For having had done that and knowing where it's going, I'm going to get an enhanced sense of accomplishment when it's actually fucking done. But I also know that my wife, my lovely wife, my tremendous wife, my great gift from God in this shitty world, right? When she pulls up every afternoon after her commute, after her day at work, she's got the same kind of feelings going on, right? So it's a basically good thing, you know? But I get more satisfaction out of actually designing it, making it the way I imagined it to be, you know, doing the work with my hands, not just slapping up some prefabricated thing and shelling out excessive fucking money for it that would just be ridiculous. I don't know how these people get away with it. Jesus God, you know. Well, I'll tell you what, I know how. I'll tell you how. Because I mentioned it in an episode before, and I don't mean to go down this trail. I'm going to get back onto the whole suburbia thing in a second here. But I know how. I know how it happens. I spoke one time about standing in line, right? How I happened to decide to pick up and start doing all my landscape work on the first really nice Saturday that we had of spring, you know? Instead of getting out in front of the whole crowd who's going to have the same inspiration. Oh, it's a pretty day. Let's go down to the nursery or the Home Depot, as the case was, right? And we'll buy, you know, we'll get some nice little pretty flowers, you know, and we'll spend the day doing the flowers in the garden. So, I'm standing in a line of like 8,542 fucking people who all had the same notions as that person did. And like, I'm in line, and I told the story before, I'm just repeating myself now. Me and my wife were standing in the line, and we got this big old cart full of, like, you know, I don't know how many fucking, like, a dozen fucking 50-pound sacks of marble stone, and, I don't know, half a dozen big bags of mulch, and all this wood and all this other shit, right? Like, we're going to do a fucking landscaping project. And what these other people doing, they bought three bricks and like two marigolds, and that's like going to be their day, like landscaping, right? So that same person might decide, oh, wouldn't our bricks and our marigold look pretty if we had a little white picket fence behind it, right? And it would, of course it would, right? And they go to the little white picket fence section, and all they get to choose from is that little short thing that I didn't want that costs like $30 a length. Or to get something a little nicer, they're in for $75. And they'll buy that one length. That one length. Well, we can afford the $75, you know. Now, $30 seems a little much, but that's the cheapest thing they got. That's how it happens. That's who they're selling that shit to. I guess I'm taking such an attitude about it now because I've bought these things before. It was never a consideration. It's like, the biggest problem was whether you really wanted to just slap one of those fences up or not. If you decided you wanted to, you know, all right, like $30 in my pocket, the whole fucking job is done. And it only takes an hour to do. Anyway, okay, that's been said, that's been done. So, the American dream, right? That's my little artistic rendition of the American dream in my the questionable little neighborhood there, right?
The Gray Area monologue is continued in the next post-Arlen Monologics release, Chapter 43, Gray Area, Part 2.
Thank you for tuning into Post-Arlen Monologics. Please understand that this project is meant to be part of a long-term archive as a series of snapshots reflecting a distant past. We are not seeking advertisers, but may at times accept private anonymous donations to help mitigate production costs. Further information involving this project and archived releases of Post-Arlen Monologics can be accessed over the World Wide Web at postarlen.com and at onsert.com. Comments, critiques, and inquiries may be submitted to Maverick through email at maverick88@postarlen.com.